This is Roy O'Bolan speaking again. I wanted to put in some of the Creighton stories in here somewhere. It seems that the stories are told mostly, of course, by my father-in-law, John Creighton. When he was a pretty good-sized boy, he thought he would like to go on a cattle drive. And he begged until his folks let him go, because his old Ed Stemmer was coming by on it, driving a bunch of cattle that was he was taking somewhere. I never learned that part of the story, but anyhow, John went along, and they had drove the cattle down to Bull Canyon to spend the night, and they drove him inside the mouth of the canyon, and then they spread out their bed rolls and lay down in the mouth of the canyon so the cattle would stay in there. And John bedded down with old Ed Stemmer. He had a good horse robe over him, and everything was comfortable, but pretty soon my old Ed began to squirm, and he began to scratch, and he fiddled around scratching and squirming and making John awful nervous. And pretty soon old Ed said, "Well, you don't need to worry," he says, "I've got cooties, and all you have to do is go, when you get home in the morning, is take a good hot bath, and that'll get rid of them." So John, the next morning, I don't know whether he slept any then after that night, but he took off early in the next morning for the ride back home, which was several miles. And when he got rode into the yard, why, Grandma Creighton, his mother, was out in the yard, and he rode up and he says, "Put the boiler on, Ma." And she says, "Well, what for?" Well, he says, "Old Ed told me that he had cooties and I'd better take a hot bath." So that tickled Grandma Creighton, and she said, "Well, old Ed, he was just a kid in you." One dark night, why, Grandma Creighton had to go to the bathroom, which was an outside toilet, but it was a real dark night, and he just didn't have a light, so he was going through the room with his arm stuck straight out, so try to not run into something. But lo and behold, he went right astraddle of an open door with his hands and hit his nose and boogered his nose up pretty bad. These ordinary boys, they couldn't help but kid him about his nose being longer than his arms. Grandpa Creighton built a log barn and made the doors 6 foot high. He was already a 6 foot man, and he had a little manure in the bottom of the door. Why, he'd forget to duck his head, so he's always boogering up his head and going through the barn doors. And these kids was always ratting him about not knowing enough to build the doors high enough so he could walk through. Grandpa Creighton collected eggs and cheese and butter around the neighborhood, and then peddled them in Cheyenne. That took several days to time it go to Cheyenne and back and do the peddling. So Aunt Mary was the babysitter at home, and she told that she had a hip that was out of place and a little high, and that was because she carried John as a baby on her hip as she did the housework around there, and told about the times that when it was rainy, why, the old roof on the house leaked, and she had to set out pans all around and on the beds and things to catch the water. Back in those days, it was free range, and cattle ran all over the country, so somebody had to herd them away from the garden. Of course, the people needed the gardens to raise them to eat. It was somebody's idea in the Creighton family to, as soon as Aunt Mary was of age, why, she took a homestead in Wyoming, from the edge of Wyoming, running straight west, a quarter of a mile wide and a mile long. And then Norman took a homestead from there on west, another mile. And then they put a fence on the north side of that, so that the range cattle from the north couldn't come south so easily. But lo and behold, it made the rancher mad that had the free range, and so he sent some cowboys out one night, and they cut the wires in between the posts all the way, the 2 miles. That didn't daunt the Creighton brothers any. Next morning they went out and tied the wires together, and that was the end of the free-range battle up there. The log barns were pretty low, like we said. Grandpa Creighton didn't build the doors even very high so he could get in, so they had a milk cow, a little caller Bessie, and a big storm came up in the night, and the first thing you know, in the morning, the first kid looked out, said, "Good lad, look at Bessie, what's she doing up there on the ridgepole of the barn?" Well, she'd walked up a snowbank, and they're in the dark, and a blizzard was driving her or something, and anyhow, she fell through the roof of the old log barn and right astraddle of the ridgepole. Well, John told the story and laughed so hard that I never did learn how they got that old cow off the ridgepole. That'd be a little bit of a problem, wouldn't it? Edna Parks Creighton came to board with Grandpa Creighton's when she taught her first term in the Spire School. She was a pretty young little gal, only 16 years old, and was quite a good-looking little gal, I imagine. And the boys liked to tease her, especially Uncle George. Edna didn't know what to do with that kind of teasing, so she and Grandma got their heads together and decided to sew Uncle George's pants leg together and see what happened. Pants leg together, and he'd have a problem. So they did that, and had the fun of listening to him upstairs, thump, thump, thumping around, and he trying to get his one leg through the pants leg. So Edna Parks Creighton got her revenge on Uncle George. The story is told that Pat O'Grady was quite a drunk and quite a rounder and quite a joke to the people in Harrisburg, and one time he got so drunk that he didn't know where he was, and he was crawling around on the floor of the livery stable underneath the horses, and they kicked and tromped on him so bad that he was pretty badly scarred up. He had one ear that was practically kicked off, and so when he got prohibition came in, and the old-timers thought, boy, that'd be a good joke to just elect Pat O'Grady sheriff, and then they could drink all the liquor they wanted to. But old Pat O'Grady, he straightened up and got him a Model T Ford and took his office seriously, and he used to come up to the crossroads at the church and wait to catch a bootlegger up there. And so the old-timers weren't so sure they did a very good job of electing the sheriff. In 1917, my mother went over to help Aunt Bernice And while over there, why, Uncle Eb was going up to the hills to get some rocks to build a foundation on one of the buildings that he was building. So Willard and I went along, and the bluffs north of W.W. Peters was very interesting to climb around on while Uncle Eb was loading rocks. And I was in the lead of going around the top of a bluff up there, and there was a rock that just butted out over a gap looking straight down to the ground. And I could stepped on that rock a jutting out there and made it across the gap perfectly all right. But I looked back and Willard had stepped on it and it broke off and he fell clear down to the bottom. And I dashed down to the bottom to see how bad he was hurt. He was just coming to. And he asked me to be sure not to tell his dad, Uncle Eb. Then in 18 or 19, Uncle Eb bought an Oakland touring car and was very proud of it. And there was a Chautauqua or some kind of a program anyhow over at the Gearing, and he and Aunt Bernice and, of course, Willard, they came over to take Mother and me along over to Gearing to visit Grandma Rice in the afternoon and to then go to the show in the evening. Well, Uncle Eb had a good head of hair and thick, and so Willard never did see a man without any hair. At the program, we were sitting waiting for the program to start. Why, Willard was looking around at the crowd, and it was a big crowd, and he said, all of a sudden he said, "Hey, Mama, look, there's a man down there that doesn't have any hair on his head." That old Oakland car almost killed Uncle Eb one time, and they were coming home from town. The old road up Carter Canyon was pretty steep, and most everybody had trouble getting up that with a car. They had to jump out, and somebody did, and while they was trying to make it, and they'd have to pause, why, somebody would jump out and grab a rock and throw down behind the rear wheel to hold it until the car got up its steam and the motor wound up so they could make it up over the steep part of the hill. Well, somebody didn't get the rock in good, and Uncle Eb was trying to make it up the hill, and the car rolled back and rolled down the canyon and tipped over and actually scared him to death, but he guess it didn't hurt him very bad. So he never would ever go over Carter Canyon again, either over it or down it, unless he absolutely had to, he was scared that bad. My first year of school, I had to walk that about 2.5 miles to school, and it was a cold, snowy day, not too much snow on the ground, but it was snowing, and so I went walk across the quarter north of us, and there was a bunch of horses up there on that. Naturally, when a kid or a little kid goes out there, the horses come running down to have a look to see the kid. So that gave me an idea. I didn't want to go to school anyhow, so I concocted an idea, that story to tell my mother that the horses chased me and I got lost and wandered around, found myself up on the hill by the telephone line, which was up by Ammerman's. And I found my way back home, and I was really cold. And so that didn't bother my mother a bit. She says, "Well, you just need to warm up your hands. We'll just fix that up real quick. You can warm them up by washing the dishes." Now, Mother had a habit of, because there was only the two of us, that there wasn't many dishes to wash at one time. So because she would let them accumulate, and they got old and dried on, and she had a whole dishpan of them, needed washing, so she heated up some water, and then I warmed my hands washing her dishes. Well, I think that's the last time I pulled any whitter on my mother. The horses that Mother bought to take the place of old Pokesy were horses that you could ride. Both of them were riding horses, but there was one especially good, and she thought that I ought to ride a horse to school instead of trying to walk. And it turned out that the horses were pretty tall, you know, and pretty hard for me to get on to. Well, she left that up to me, mostly. She did coach me a little about trying to shinny up a horse's leg to get on top of them and things, and put me on the horse one day to start to school, and the horse was very careful with the little kids and walked so slow that even couldn't get her to go fast, and just walked so slow that I was late time I got to school and came over the hill by the schoolhouse. Well, the bell just rang and the kids started lining up to go into the school, and I decided I better hurry up a little, so I kicked the horse into a stiff-legged trot and proceeded to fall right off of her. And the kids were all looking, of course, and that made me kind of embarrassed. It wasn't long, though, till I could ride that horse full speed bareback anywhere I wanted to go. And one night when I was coming home from school, well, it was a snowy day, and there was a lot of snow on the ground that day. And I went by the corner of the Ammerman Quarter, which is right where the old community concert stands. I went right around that corner and went south. Lynn Williams has lived there then, and so this night I went tearing around this corner and didn't slow down at all, and the horse's feet slipped out from under, and I found myself in a snowbank, and the horse got right up and I climbed up on a post and jumped back on her and took off again and went home. But there was Hazel Williams and Mabel Loafman, or Ammerman at that time, looking out the window of Lynn Williams' house, and they saw me take that spill. Grace Minner was my teacher a couple of terms, and one of those terms, why, she boarded at Lynn Williams's, and one of those times, why, Mother came by and picked me up to bring me home after school, and so Grace Minner came along back to Lynn's, which was about a mile and a half, just so she had a ride, you know, and visited, and she was all full of an embarrassing moment and a story she had to tell, and it seemed that she was told the week before, she told Lynn that she was going to go to town and get her hair cut, which incidentally in those days the women were all have their hair cut in a bob style, just chopped off all the way around, front and back and side, but they'd started to shingle it up the back, make it look a little neater, and so Grace Minner told Lynn, "I'm going to town then Saturday and get my hair cut like a boy's behind." He never did get over kidding her about getting her hair cut like a boy's behind. By the time I was 9 years old, why, my mother thought I was old enough to take the team of horses and go to LaGrange with some eggs and get the groceries. She would give me a list, and all I had to do was give it to the store clerk and they would fill the order. Well, I went to LaGrange, all right, and had trouble opening some gates. I was so small. And I arrived up by John Creighton place and had to open a gate there, and as I drove up to that gate, a little Lucy, she came in running out and with a piece of cake to give me, and she said that when it came back, why, she'd have some strawberries for me. So I never did. After I finally married her, and Edna Creighton was my mother-in-law, I liked to kid her about trying to get her a son-in-law and sending her little 7-year-old girl out to court me clear back. Well, I made it to LaGrange all right and got the groceries and came back by Will Creighton's. As I came by there, well, of course, it's on the road, and he rode out and sat down in the back of the buggy and visited with me all those 2 miles. And I got acquainted with Uncle Will Creighton that way. And I went by the John Creighton place. I naturally, I stopped and picked up my strawberries and went on home. Back to when I was just a little boy, and 18 or 19, I suppose, why, Jess Hammerman brought his niece, Helen Jones, and I, and we went to the circus over in Scott's Bluff. He took us along, just the two little kids and him. And we went to over there and watched the circus parade from Grant Shemley's office window, looking down on the parade coming down Broadway. At least I imagine it was Grant Shemley, I don't know for sure. I lost it. We, of course, went to the Big Top and sat and watched the show. But before that, old Jess had to go up to the ticket window to buy our tickets. And all of a sudden he says, "Good God, you don't charge that much for these little kids." You could hear him for 3-4 blocks, you know. Well, we enjoyed the show anyhow and watched this. Got to tour around the tents and see all the animals, and the elephants was quite a thrill to little kids, you know, and we had some peanuts to give them, and we ate most of the peanuts ourselves. And there, Grandma Rice had quite a bit on the ball back in those days. She even got her cross-eyed fixed up down in Omaha. She came back, she was a better-looking woman, and she had quite a number of boyfriends, and seemed like they were after what little money she had, and apparently she loaned some of them some money, or one of them at least, and he had a Cadillac, and he brought her out to our place and to show off the Cadillac, and took us for a ride over to see the wheat harvest over on the section which was being combined by a combine pulled by 18 head of horses. So Grandma Rice finally had to take this Cadillac for the money that this fellow owed her. And she had a Cadillac that she didn't know what to do with, and Uncle Eb had a wrecked car. So she sold the Cadillac to Uncle Eb, and he had this Cadillac until 1928 when he traded it for another Oakland car. In the first part of this tape, I find I have omitted a few items, and so I'll try to tell you about them. Len and Zell Early, in later years, adopted a girl who was several years old and gave her an education. There was a Jackson family that lived southeast of the church, about and south of the Packard place. They didn't come to church, so I didn't be acquainted with them when I was young, but they did have a son, Charlie, that used to come to church now and then when I was a young man about my age. Floyd Neisonger moved in a mile and a quarter north of the church in about 1920 or later, and they had Florence, Ethel, Jim, Lloyd, Mary, and Edna. There was Charlie McCumsey, who had a homestead 4 miles north and 2 west of the church. They also had a son, John McCumsey, who homesteaded farther west near Double Hump, and he married Sarah Shoemaker, and they had a daughter, Marie. The elder Shoemakers homesteaded what is now the Carlson Ranch. Then Walt Shoemaker homesteaded the half section that is also in the Carlson Ranch. They sold out to W.W. Peters and they took another homestead north of the John McCumsey place. And Walt Shoemaker moved to Harrisburg. William Shoemaker had his homestead 4.5 miles north and on the east side of the road. Had a log cabin when we came there in 1917, but he had moved to Mitchell, like a lot of other homesteaders did. His place became part of the Carlson Ranch. At this point, I should tell how come Alec Carlson came into the picture. My stepfather, Alec Carlson, was born June 18, 1888, in Sweden. He had 2 younger brothers, and some time before 1896, his father died. So a brother who was already over here in Mitchell Valley sent for his brother's widow to come over here and marry him. At the age of 8, Alex remembers coming across the ocean and seeing the Statue of Liberty. His mother had a brother in Mitchell Valley, Uncle John Engstrom. Alex's mother had been married about a year when she had a little girl, Anna. Shortly after that, she took sick and died, leaving the boys orphans. Their stepfather didn't want to be bothered, so Uncle John Engstrom was instrumental in getting them placed in homes. W.W. Peters took Alex at the age of 10 years old to live with him. At that time, Peters lived in Mitchell, had a big irrigated farm out south of Mitchell. So Alex grew up irrigating beets and putting up alfalfa hay, doing a lot of work for a 10-year-old kid. Went to school in Mitchell Valley. Mr. Peters' ranch was out where John George's lived, or where Jack Preston now lives. By the time Alec Carlson was 21, There were several isolated 40s in Mr. Peters's ranch, so Alec could take a Kincaid and take those 40s as part of his Kincaid. And eventually